Let's say you're one of the most highly respected scientists in your field. Let's say you're a patriot. Let's say that you're committed to providing the best technical analysis and leadership possible, all while trying to maintain the highest level of ethics. Many of the hundreds of thousands of people who work in the American military-industrial complex would describe themselves in exactly this way. So why are there so few whistleblowers? We'll discuss that with our next guest. I'm John Kiriakou. Welcome to The Whistleblowers. Subrata Ghoshroi was an engineer for nearly 20 years in both civilian and military research, much of it at the start of his career related to the so-called Strategic Defense Initiative, President Reagan's idea for a space-based anti-missile system that detractors called Star Wars.
Let me share with you a vision of the future which offers hope. It is that we embark on a program to counter the awesome Soviet missile threat with measures that are defensive. What if free people could live secure in the knowledge that their security did not rest upon the threat of instant U.S. retaliation to deter a Soviet attack, that we could intercept and destroy strategic ballistic missiles before they reached our own soil or that of our allies? I know this is a formidable technical task, one that may not be accomplished before the end of this century. Yet current technology has attained a level of sophistication where it's reasonable for us to begin this effort.
In the early 1980s, he was working in a research laboratory developing high-powered lasers for missile defense. After some time, it became clear to the research engineers performance requirements greatly exceeded the capabilities of even the Pentagon's most sophisticated technology. It just didn't work. But work on these lasers continued as if no problems existed. Congress approved more and more money, and the Pentagon gladly sent that money on to the defense contractors. Eventually, it became clear to Subrata that the program would fail, but it continued for several more years until the weight of the lie of its operability became too much and the project fell apart. Subrata attempted to bring these problems to the attention of his superiors, but he failed. He also approached program managers with his concerns, but again, he had no success. The question then was what to do next. With highly technical skills not easily transferable, Subrata had to decide whether to blow the whistle or to just go along to get along. We're happy to be joined by Subrata Ghoshroi. Thank you so much for being with us, Subrata.
Thank you, John. It's my pleasure.
Take us back to the early 1980s. President Reagan, in a nationally televised address, told the American people that he was taking the arms race to space, and he announced the creation of the Strategic Defense Initiative, or Star Wars. I assume that you had already been working on the project for some time. How long was it before you realized that this project just simply wasn't going to work? And how were your colleagues reacting? They were seeing the same results that you were seeing, after all.
So the project got started in full swing about 84, 85, because he announced it in 1983 in a major speech, which later came to, where he called the Soviet Union the evil empire, and then talked about the shield that he was going to build to stop Soviet missiles. So that was 1983. So I think our contract really got rolling 84, 85. We have been working on laser on smaller contracts before that, but now the money really came in tens of millions. So we grew in a big way. And that went on until, let's say, for 1989. So 5 years, 6 years. And after Reagan left the office and President Bush came in, George Bush, 41, and is at that time, Bush was intelligent enough to realize that all this technology that we have been claiming we have all over the place in the United States, where these are just mostly science fiction. And he really was quickly pulling it back. So, and then Bill Clinton came in 92, and he put a big kibosh on the Star Wars research. So this transition happened sometime between 89 and 92, when a lot of our colleagues also, as you correctly asked the question, what were they thinking? Many of them knew this is not good, but this was a common refrain I was told by our senior VP. Don't you want to pay your mortgage? And so if we don't lie, then some other people will lie and get the contract, and you'll be you know, holding the bag, so to speak.
You made a conscious decision to go through your chain of command, and you told your superiors that the science just simply didn't support the policy. Tell us about some of the specifics there. You made one specific complaint at the beginning that was about a laser's weight. Can you tell us what that was all about?
Yes. Well, the laser was for space basing. That's where the controversy happened. Before that, we were mostly developing lasers in the laboratory, and we didn't pay attention to the weight. So what we were paying attention to is, will the laser lase properly? Will the laser put out the right amount of power? And can we build an engineering prototype and then actually a full bore fieldable laser after we have proven the physics of the laser? That is the key, that it had to work in the laboratory. The physics had to be done right. And then we can build a prototype. That would be the normal procedure. But here, the process of doing this in the physics phase is when we discovered in the laboratory, far from actually addressing the weight question. But we discovered in the laboratory one particular piece of information, that to make the laser small, we have to pump the laser very, very hard. And if we couldn't pump the laser very hard, then the system would grow and for the same amount of energy output, so we won't get the weight. And so we just said, yes, we have demonstrated ABC, which was completely not right. So this was a fundamental physics limit that prohibited us from claiming the kind of weight that we would get, because we couldn't pump it that hard. The laser wouldn't work if we pump it that hard.
You didn't get any satisfaction from your superiors, so you went to the program managers. What happened there?
Yeah, so it was not an official complaint, like written complaint. So I talked to a top program manager on the laser programs for the Army, which was leading the lasers at that time for the Star Wars program. And it was a very nice man, and we had very cordial relations because we always go to briefings, we brief them, and afterward have a beer or play some volleyball, whatever. And these are scientist-to-scientist contacts, but when I actually went to them with my specific complaints about the claims we were making that are not verifiable, demonstrable, and there are physics limits, he really did not respond. I later found out that when I had filed the QITAM, is that and DOJ eventually refused to join, the same program manager, high-level scientist at DOD, came back to DOJ saying, well, these are all experiments. So we have different things with experiments, with some fail, some don't fail. Well, it wasn't, because we were building actually equipment that will fly in space if it could. So he basically deflated DOJ, senior Pentagon scientists, telling DOJ that, hey, this is R&D.
I'd like to ask our guests to hold on and remain with us. We're going to take a short break and come back for more of our conversation with U.S. Defense Department whistleblower Subrata Ghosh Roy. Stay tuned.
I feel that Pakistanis are still working through the journey of developing an identity, a national identity. There is, you know, we talked earlier about the vibrancy and the dynamics of the media, where all sorts of views and narratives have a chance to debate and come to the fore. But that also has a downside in that everything is up for debate, so nothing is agreed on.
We'll be right back. So what we've got to do is identify the threats that we have.
It's crazy.
Confrontation, let it be an arms race.
Who is on offense? Very dramatic development.
I personally am going to resist.
I don't see how that strategy will be successful.
Very critical time.
Time to sit down and talk.
Потребление наркотиков в Южной Америке в целом, в Бразилии в частности, на очень высоком уровне.
Кокаина. Só que aqui, olha, uma sacola dessa custa 30 reais.
E vindo ter, principalmente o norte, ele é muito falado, não.
Мы не знаем, что на этой реке происходит. Контроля здесь вообще практически никакого нет.
Eles conseguiram pegar quase uma tonelada aqui. Foi pego 420 quilos, depois foi pego mais 300 e poucos quilos pela polícia militar.
Vem, Karim.
Por aqui alguém morreu recentemente?
Já muita gente.
Ei, quem é você? Saia daqui! Eu tenho um facão.
Beleza!
Plantando ali no meio do mato. Então essa área todinha era comandada pelos traficantes, entendeu?
Tá? Aqui entra!
Каждый день убивают и много. Там просто дикий запад. По мне, Амазонка, да, это кокаиновая река. Большинство поставок идет через Амазонку.
Só a venda, porque a procura. Se não tivesse procura, não ia ter venda.
Eu sustento três filhos, né? Duas meninas, um menino e mais uma esposa. Cinco no caso.
Welcome back to The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. We're speaking with U.S. Defense Department whistleblower Subrata Ghoshroi. Subrata, welcome back. You lived with this for more than a decade, and then you decided to accept a congressional fellowship for less than half of your previous salary. With that said, your fellowship was with one of the most important members of Congress at that time, the then-ranking member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Representative Lee Hamilton. At the end of that fellowship, you went to work for one of my own personal heroes, Representative Ron Dellums, who was then the ranking member of the Armed Services Committee. You developed a new expertise on the military appropriations process, and it was with this new expertise that you were able to blow the whistle yet again, this time on a missile defense program called the Airborne Laser. It took another decade, but that program was eventually canceled. Tell us about that experience.
John, first of all, a little correction. The whistleblowing at GAO happened not on the airborne laser. I can talk for a long time about airborne laser, but it was on a different part of the missile defense system. It was called the, at that time, National Missile Defense, and now it's called the GMD, which is the Ground-Based Mid-Course Defense. It is about defense of United States against strategic, meaning intercontinental ballistic missiles coming from the so-called rogue states like DPRK, Iran, Libya at that time, Iraq, and not to they didn't mention China or Russia, but these are the threats that they were countering in building what's called a hit-to-kill system of intercontinental ballistics. And that was the basic building block of Reagan's Star Wars.
I said at the start of the show that you elected in the 1980s to go through your chain of command to report your concerns. That got you nowhere, but it made you a whistleblower. You continued that whistleblowing on Capitol Hill while working with two of the most important members of Congress. But a major revelation that you made came even later when you were working as a senior analyst with the Government Accountability Office, or GAO. For those of our viewers who don't know what the GAO is, it's supposed to be the ultra-ethical governmental entity that ensures the highest ethical standards in government. But that wasn't your experience at GAO, was it?
Yes, that was the most, I still have deep respect, I would say, for most people at my level or somewhat lower level than me at GAO. They are very sincere public servants. They do extremely good research and try to write the best report they can at that level. And I was trying to be basically one of them. I was a fairly senior person there because I'd come from Congress and I had broad technical experience, which nobody did. And I was actually in the beginning, my boss who hired me out of the congressional committee, Lou Rodrigues, it was a fantastic man. He was the head of the National Security and International Affairs Division, and he had interacted with me while I was on the committee staff. And so he hired me once he found out Vellums had quit. And I would be gone because somebody like Ike Skelton had taken over at Armed Services, who is this ultra-conservative from Missouri. And anyway, so Lou was excellent, and under Lou, I was doing really well at GAO. I got most of the assignments were basically somewhat technical in nature because they had only me and a couple of other people who were technical, and so it was great. And then came this project to review the allegations of fraud in the National Missile Defense Program. So my boss, Bob Levin, and he said, Subrata, this looks like just up your alley, all this missile defense stuff. So they gave me the job as the technical lead technical evaluator for the project, and I was assisted by another senior person, Dave Hand, who was doing most of the GAO work for the project, and I was doing all the review and things. And everything was going very well. Bob Levin was fantastically supportive of everything I wanted to do, to interview so many people at the Pentagon, request absolutely original documents, tapes from the test, and all that stuff. Bob was totally behind me. But when it came 2 years later, when it came to writing the report, we were already facing some resistance from the legal department in GAO, and they had one of their people, a senior legal person, who just had come from Pentagon. And so she had pretty close connection with the Pentagon people, and I think it was through her that most of the influence initially came, that, look, guys, I mean, you really have to tone this thing down and so forth. I mean, I don't know the exact words. I was not part of the conversation. But the net product was I was writing results of my analyses and review of documents in secret, secured, compartmentalized, information. John knows all about that. And we're sitting there, can't take out anything, working day after day after day, looking at the secret documents and taking mental notes and trying to get some things declassified so we could go publish the report properly. So I was succeeding. There are many, many stories that go along with this time. But the bottom line was they basically put a kibosh on the report of what I could say. So I write a paragraph that the test was a total failure. And in fact, the Boeing chief scientist, Bob Caswell, who kind of became my friend, and he just said, look, Subrata, I mean, this is politics. So this is Boeing chief scientist.
You became the first whistleblower in GAO's 98-year history, now 100-year history. Your whistleblowing this time centered on your discovery of fraud by contractors in the missile defense program. You allege that GAO covered up the wrongdoing. First, why would they do that when their job is to do exactly the opposite? And what was the fallout?
The GAO takes pride on being nonpartisan and that it is the watchdog of Congress. It's bipartisan, of course. So, but in reality, GAO has to worry about its budget every year. Its budget is approved by the Legislative Affairs Committee in the Senate. And so there is some hearings and stuff where the GAO chief has to make a budget presentation and so forth. And when I was joining GAO in 1998, just before that, after the Republican takeover in 1994 with Newt Gingrich, they really went big time against GAO. GAO lost a huge number of people in this interregnum between 1994 and in 1998 when I joined. That was the height of the Republican revolution, Gingrich revolution, and they went after the GAO. They eliminated the only scientific, somewhat independent organization within Congress, which was called the Office of Technology Assessment, OTA. OTA had a staff of 200 people, mostly PhDs, and budget was $20 million. Can you imagine? I mean, that kind of money is nothing for Pentagon. And they cut it. They just gutted the agency, it's gone. So no independent scientific voice for Congress. Similarly for GAO, they went after GAO. So the GAO management realized that because the Republicans would accuse them of just doing the job for mostly Democrats. Not that the Democrats were that terrific on national security, but on other social issues, they were very many times very good. So GAO would write some scathing reports on the Health and Human Services Department, the education, the commerce, and all this stuff. But they didn't do that for the Pentagon, because the Pentagon committees that supervised GAO, the House Armed Services, which I was on it, and the Senate Armed Services, they were primarily Republicans, of course, gung-ho Republicans like Duncan Hunter from California, who just want defense budget to grow like mad and no criticism of the Defense Department. And Democrats were just trying to get money from the Pentagon budget and just ship it to their constituency. So either way, there was no kind of supervision of, so GAO didn't have any backing when it came to the Pentagon. But other stuff they had a little bit. But they got their lesson. Said, gee, and Republicans were very powerful. And at one time they'd taken over Congress, Senate and House both, with Trent Lott there and Gingrich there. So it was impossible for them to do really independent work. So it's the political pressure was number one. They were very afraid. So everything is just go down the middle, he said, she said, whatever. And on the one hand, on the other hand, so don't say nothing. And that's the political atmosphere where this report was coming out. And missile defense, you have to know, it is Ronald Reagan's pet program, correct. But he was representing this community of people at Los Alamos, at Livermore, people who have been advocating getting out of the ABM treaty and go against Russia, first strike and all this stuff. They didn't want any kind of cuts to the missile defense. So that was the situation.
Being a whistleblower, especially in national security, can be a very lonely life. But you had some significant support. Tell us about that, and tell us how the rest of your career has gone. You certainly seem to have landed on your feet.
Well, looks could be deceiving, but no, I think that's I was very careful. First of all, I had to be careful for many reasons, because I'm one of the first scientist, engineer, whistleblower who's talking about technical issues, not financial. I mean, there's plenty of financial fraud that happens in the Pentagon, but people like Snowden, of course, revealed fantastic information, but they're not per se technical. And Pentagon has this R&D budget, which is now over $120 billion. And under that, the missile defense program fits. And this R&D budget is a very lucrative gravy train for the contractors. So they are guarding it, tremendously. So I had to be very careful that I was a foreign-born, and I had very high level security clearance because I was in Congress at the committee at the highest level as a professional staff member who was responsible for the RDT&E budget for the Democrats at that time, because we were only seven people on the minority staff. So I had a huge portfolio that was amounting $54 billion at that time to kind of keep look at the budget and also make sure that the interests of the Democrat members were properly taken care of. So, and Ron didn't care about this kind of stuff, but the many other members did. So I had a sensitivity that I was a foreign-born person with high security clearance, and I was dealing with very, very sensitive information because of the just the politics of these programs against Russia, China, whatever. So there was both foreign policy ramifications and technical. So I had to be extremely careful that I couldn't just go out there and say things just to get publicity. That's why it was so quiet, and I didn't get the kind of appreciation. And being a foreign-born a minority person of color, it wasn't easy to function in a very, very white national security establishment. So it definitely tempered what I could say, what I could do. But I also had kept very good relations with Bob Blumenfeld, Congressman Berman's chief of staff. Bob is a friend. And he and Congressman Berman were very careful, continuously telling GAO that you don't take adversarial or negative steps against Mr. Ghoshroy. So I think GAO didn't dare do that, but they had their ways of making my life quite miserable.
I would like to thank our guest, Subrata Ghoshroy, and thank you, our viewers, for joining us again. The great author William Faulkner once said, "Never be afraid to raise your voice for honesty and truth and compassion against injustice and lying and greed. If people all over the world would do this, it would change the entire planet." We'll leave you with those words. Thanks again for joining us.